Nirodhamma, New Science, Ancient Wisdom, and Seven Practices of the Highest Happiness. Part 1, Embodied Practice. Mind and Life. If, by giving up a lesser happiness, one could experience a greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. Dhammapada 290. Hiked up a lot of mountains, and sometimes a friend further up the trail has turned and looked back and encouraged me onward. Such a friendly gesture. Come join me. Watch out for the slippery ice. You can do it. I've often thought about those moments. Book is about the heights of human potential, about being as wise and strong, happy and loving as any person can ever be. If those heights are like a great mountain, awakening is the magnificent journey that carries you along toward the top. Many real people have gone very far up, and I imagine them turning with a sweet smile and beckoning us to join them. Those who have climbed this mountain come from different cultures and have different personalities. But they all seem alike in seven ways. They are mindful, they are kind, they live with contentment and emotional balance, they are whole and authentic, they are present here and now. They speak of feeling connected, and a light shines through them that does not seem entirely their own. You might have your own examples of inspiring people you've heard about, or whose words you've read or listened to, or perhaps even met. These individuals are models to us of what is possible. They are down to earth, humorous, realistic, and supportive. Not the cartoon-like stereotype of exotic characters in caves making cryptic pronouncements. They have no interest in celebrity. Their realization is genuine, and it's the result of the path they've traveled. Through their own example, they demonstrate wonderful ways of being lie ahead. Accessible paths lead onward, and that much as your own efforts were fruitful, ours can be too. And remarkably, you can see some of their qualities already deep down inside yourself, even if they're sometimes covered over by stresses and distractions. These ways of being are not reserved for the few. They are opportunities for all of us, and we'll be exploring how to develop them in these seven practices of awakening. Studying the mind, warming the heart, resting in fullness, being wholeness, receiving nowness, opening into allness, finding timelessness. There are many traditions which are like many routes up the mountain of awakening. Nonetheless, on each of these routes, we find the same steps taken again and again. This is some of the most profound and sacred, perhaps sacred territory there is. It is ultimately beyond science and logic, so words about it can be loose, metaphorical, and poetic. The complete development of these seven ways of being marks the pinnacle of human possibility, which could be called enlightenment or awakening. Meanwhile, even the first simple sense of them is very useful. For instance, when dealing with stressful challenges, it's so good to rest in the fullness of feeling already peaceful, happy, and loved. And whether it is for the beginning of the path or its end, today we have an unprecedented opportunity to explore a kind of reverse engineering of awakening that is grounded in the living body. Aiming high. Neuroscience is a young science. Still, we can study examples of those who have gone far up the mountain and ask, how do you do that? What must be happening in your body so that you stay centered when things are falling apart? What changes in your brain help you be compassionate and strong when others are hurtful or threatening? What is the underlying neural basis for engaging life without any sense of craving, greed, hatred, or delusion? These aren't yet neurologically definitive answers. There aren't yet neurologically definitive answers to these questions. We don't know everything, but we do know more than nothing, and emerging science can highlight and explain plausibly beneficial practices. And when the science is unclear, we can still use reasonable ideas and methods. One of the things I find most inspiring about the great teachers throughout history is their invitation for full awakening. Even in early stages, you can find real benefits. Focus is more on the process of practice than the eventual destination, with the hope that you will find this useful on your own path. Still, the ultimate possibility is the complete liberation of mind and heart, with the highest happiness and most sublime peace. As we move up the trail, it steepens and the air gets thinner, so it helps to have a guidebook. For this, sometimes I'll turn to the penetrating analysis of the mind offered by the Buddha. Background in Theravadan tradition, which is practiced widely in Southeast Asia and increasingly in the West, it is sometimes called insight or vipassana-oriented practice. This tradition is grounded in the earliest record of the Buddhist teachings, the Pali Canon. Adapting and applying key ideas and methods for practical purposes here. For these and everything else in the book, I think the Buddha himself had some lovely advice. Come and see for yourself, ehi pasako, what rings true and is useful over time. A neurodharma perspective. The Buddha didn't have an MRI to become enlightened. Still, 2,600 years after he walked the dusty roads of northern India, science have discovered many things about the body and the brain. The Buddha and others have explored the mental factors of dukkha and sukha. During the past couple of decades, we've learned a lot about the neural basis of these mental factors. To ignore this emerging understanding seems antithetical to both science and to Buddhism. The Dhamma, understanding, peering into the nature of reality. The Dhamma is truth, and the only choice we really have is whether to try to be in relationship with the truth or to live in ignorance. When I use the word Dhamma, I simply mean the truth of things. This is both the way things actually are and accurate descriptions of them. Whatever the truth is, it is not the property of anyone. Neurodharma is the term used for truth of mind, grounded in truth of body, particularly the nervous system. Neurodharma is, not Buddhism as a whole, nor is it necessary for Buddhist or any other practice. I just think it can be helpful. We will use this approach to explore seven ways of being that are the essence of awakening. Learn about their basis in your own brain. Use this understanding to strengthen them in yourself. Even a little knowledge about your brain can be very useful. Imagine driving a car and suddenly seeing clouds of steam coming out of the front with red lights flashing on the dashboard and needing to pull over and stop. If you don't know anything about what a car is made of and how it works, you're pretty stuck. But if you know about the radiator and types of fluid it needs to keep the engine cool, then there are things you can do to get back on the road and prevent this in the future. The car is like the body. Thousands of years ago, nobody knew much about it, but today we can draw on the knowledge we've gained over the centuries about our neural engine. For starters, this knowledge is motivating. When you know that your practices are actually changing your brain, you're more likely to keep doing them. It's nice to have something that's verifiable. Really taking your body into account can also draw you into a sense of thankfulness for the physical processes that have led to this moment of consciousness. Understanding what is happening in your brain while experiences are moving through your mind sharpens your mindfulness and fosters insight. You can lighten up about the passing show of consciousness when you recognize that it's being made by many tiny, swift, cellular and molecular processes without any sort of master engineer hiding in the background and continually flipping all the right switches. In its basic design, we've all got the same brain. A neurodharma perspective offers a common framework for understanding the ideas and tools in clinical psychology, personal development, a broad term for other secular approaches, and the wisdom traditions. It can help us prioritize and use key tools we already have. For example, research on the brain's evolved negativity bias, which we'll learn more about in Chapter 3, highlights the importance of emotionally positive experiences such as gladness and kindness. A greater understanding of the neural hardware can even suggest new approaches to our mental software, such as neurofeedback. It also helps to individualize practice. When you consider your temperament as a perfectly normal variation on the human brain, it's easier to be self-accepting and to find practices that are most suited to you. This approach invites us to work backward from important experiences, such as feeling happy and content, and explore their basis in the brain. We can know ourselves both subjectively and objectively, from the inside out and from the outside in. The Neurodhamma is where those two meet. At the same time, we can respect what we don't know and avoid merely intellectual practice. I try to remember the Buddha's advice to steer clear of the thicket of views and opinions about theoretical matters and to focus instead on the practical how of alleviating dukkha and finding true happiness here and now. A path that progresses. The seven themes of this book, steadiness of mind, warmth of heart, and so forth, have been explored in many ways by many people in many traditions. They involve experiencing what is out in the open and not hidden. We can be more mindful and loving. We can afford to crave less. We are innately whole. This moment is the only moment there is, and each person exists interdependently with everything else. These ways of being are accessible to all of us, and their essence is available without years of rigorous training. I'll offer suggestions for how you can have a greater sense of them, as well as guided meditations that will go deeply into these experiences. You can also weave them into activities you're already doing, such as going for a walk. You don't need a background in science or meditation to develop a greater sense of contentment or kindness, or the other ways of being we'll be exploring. Even 10 minutes a day spread out here and there can make a difference, if you do the practice day after day. As with anything, the more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it. What gives me both trust and hope is that it is a path we can walk step after step through our own efforts, not a magical quick fix. Unless you're already living on the top of the mountain of awakening, there remains something to do. How should we do it? Going well-being. There are two approaches to this question. One emphasizes a gradual approach that includes reducing unhappiness and growing compassion, insight, and equanimity. The other focuses on recognizing an innate perfection in which there is nothing to gain. Both of these approaches are valid and they support each other. We need to heal and grow, and we can stay in touch with our deep true nature along the way. In the mind, it takes a while to uncover who we already are. There is a saying, gradual cultivation, subtle awakening. As Milarepa, the Tibetan sage, described his life of practice, in the beginning nothing came, in the middle nothing stayed, and in the end nothing left. Meanwhile, a sense of your innate wakefulness and goodness is inspiring and encouraging. It helps you to keep going when things are boring or hard. On the long, rough road, the sun and moon will continue to shine. Thich Nhat Hanh. In the brain, trauma and ordinary neurotic crud are developed in neural circuitry, which takes time to alter. Developing happiness, emotional intelligence, and a loving heart also require gradual physical changes. At the same time, when you are not rattled or distressed, your brain settles into its innate resting state. Then it recovers from bursts of activity and releases neurochemicals such as serotonin and oxytocin that support a positive mood and kindness towards others. This is our neuropsychological home base, to be calm, contented, and caring. No matter how disturbed by stress and sorrow, we can always come home. Letting be, letting go, letting in. Developing a greater sense of fullness, wholeness, and other aspects of awakening involves three kinds of practice. First, you can simply be with whatever you're experiencing, accepting it, feeling it, perhaps exploring it. As you be with it, your experience may change, but you're not trying to nudge it in one way or another. Second, you can release what is painful or harmful, such as by easing tension in the body, venting feelings, challenging thoughts that aren't true or helpful, or disengaging from desires that hurt you or others. Third, you can grow what is enjoyable or useful, developing virtues and skills, becoming more resilient, grateful, and compassionate. In a nutshell, let be, let go, let in. If your mind is like a garden, you can observe it, pull weeds, and plant flowers. Of these, letting be is most essential, because letting go can often be pushing away, and really, in the end, it's there whether we let it be or not. It's where we start, and sometimes it's all we can do. As practice matures, increasingly we simply be with the next moment as it arises and passes away and becomes something else. But this is not the whole of practice. We can't only be with the mind. We must work with it as well. For example, most of the Noble Eightfold Path in Buddhism involves letting go and letting in, such as releasing unwise speech and replacing it with wise speech. While there are pitfalls in working with the mind, such as getting caught up in fixing oneself, there are also pitfalls in not working with it. For instance, people who are good at observing their own minds are chronically happy as well and unskillful with others. We shouldn't work with the mind in order to avoid being with it, nor be with the mind in order to avoid working with it. Letting be, letting go, and letting in form a natural sequence. Perhaps you recognize that you've gotten resentful about something and you explore its experience and let it be as it is. And also have some non-contention with it. Realize that it's impersonal, it's not self, it arises due to causes and conditions, and you can have compassion towards yourself. It can and should. Compassion and wisdom go hand in hand. At some point, it feels natural to shift into deliberately letting go, and you relax your body, help feelings flow, and step back from troublesome thoughts. Then, in the space made by what you've cleared away, you can let in what could be beneficial, such as self-compassion. Over time, the strengths you develop inside yourself will help you let be and let go even more fully. And to explore this further, you might like to try Meditation in the Box, which also contains suggestions for doing experiential practices in general. Let be, let go, let in. In this meditation and other practices, we'll offer different ways to relate to your experiences and to have ones that could be beneficial. Not all suggestions will click for you. Please find approaches that do work for you. For example, you might like to move your body to evoke a particular feeling or focus on certain images or use words that are different from those presented. What's important are the experiences having, not the methods we use to find our way into them. It's challenging to have an actual sense of something, such as the feeling of letting go. That's normal. Everyone experiences these challenges. If you feel frustrated or self-critical, that's normal too. You can simply acknowledge it and then return to whatever you are practicing, or you can actively practice compassion, karuna and metta, beneficence, non-contention. If it is hard to get in touch with something, just make a note of it, and if you like, come back to it later. It takes time and repetition to experience the ways of being we'll be exploring, especially their depths. It really is like climbing a mountain. Slow at times because it's steep, or the terrain is difficult in some one way or another. Not because you're doing it wrong, or because you can't keep making your way up. Please go at your own pace, and keep going. You could do the practice below as a kind of meditation. You can also do it informally in the flow of life. When something, I'll call it the issue, is stressful or upsetting, adapt it to your needs and take as much time as you like. Let be. Find something simple that helps you stay present, such as the feeling of breathing. Take some moments to feel increasingly centered. Let sounds and sensations, thoughts and feelings pass through awareness. Know what it's like to be with experiences without resisting or holding on to them. If you like, when you're ready, focus on the issue, especially experiences related to it. Be aware of thoughts you have about it, or be mindful of an issue that arises without having to pick one. Emotions related to it, perhaps naming them softly. Accept these thoughts and feelings, letting them flow, letting them be. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral, or neither, try to accept your experience as it is. If something is overwhelming, focus on breathing or something else that's calming and soothing. Be aware of body sensations and possibly related to the issue. Wishes and wants and plans related to it, letting them be, letting them flow. You can explore deeper layers, such as hurt or fear beneath anger, younger parts of yourself, feeling it all, letting it all be. Let go. When it feels right, shift into releasing. Be aware of any tension in your body related to the issue and let it ease and soften and relax. Let feelings flow, perhaps imagining them leaving you like a little cloud each time you exhale. Recognize any inaccurate, exaggerated, or limiting thoughts and disengage from them, letting go. Be aware of desires related to the issue, such as unrealistic goals or understandable longings that are just not going to be fulfilled. And breath after breath, let these go. You can also let go of unhelpful ways of speaking or acting. Breath after breath, let it go. Let in. Then perhaps you could focus on what could be useful, wise, or enjoyable. Perhaps there is a sense of comfort or reassurance that would feel good to open to, or gratitude, love, or self-compassion. Taking it in as you inhale, receiving whatever is good into yourself. Perhaps there is a spaciousness in your mind, like the sky after a storm passes. There could be an easing in your body. Stay with these experiences, giving yourself over to them. You might invite a sense of strength or determination. You could identify thoughts or perspectives that are true and helpful. Open to any intuitions or the voice of inner wisdom. There could be a growing clarity about how you'd like to act in the days ahead. Let whatever is helpful sink in. All these good things establishing themselves in you. Let them spread inside you. All these good things sinking into you.